miles around. Witches can see these things where other humans can't. Animals keep away, too. No birds fly there. Lemmings and foxes have fled. Hence the name, Bolvanger, the Fields of Evil. They don't call it that. They call it the station. But to everyone else it is Bolvanger.
And how are they defended?
They have a company of northern Tartars armed with rifles. They're good soldiers, but they lack practice because no one has ever attacked the settlement since it was built. Then there is a wire fence around the compound, which is filled with Anbaric force. There may be other means of defense that we don't know about, because, as I say, they have no interest for us.
Lyra was bursting to ask a question, and the goose demon knew it and looked at her as if giving permission.
Why do the witches talk about me?
Because of your father and his knowledge of the other worlds.
That surprised all three of them. Lyra looked at Father Coram, who looked back in mild wonder, and at John Farr, whose expression was troubled.
Other worlds? Well, pardon me, sir, but what worlds would those be? Do you mean the stars?
Indeed, no.
Perhaps the world of spirits?
Nor that.
Is it the city in the light? It is, ain't it?
The goose turned his stately head towards her. His eyes were black, surrounded by a thin line of pure sky blue, and their gaze was intense.
Yes. Witches have known of the other worlds for thousands of years. You can see them sometimes in the northern lights. They aren't part of this universe at all. Even the furthest stars are part of this universe. But the lights show us a different universe entirely. Not further away, but interpenetrating with this one. Here, on this deck, millions of other universes exist, unaware of one another.
He raised his wings and spread them wide before folding them again.
There. I have just brushed 10 million other worlds, and they knew nothing of it. We are as close as a heartbeat. But we can never touch or see or hear these other worlds except in the northern lights.
And why there?
Because the charged particles in the aurora have the property of making the matter of this world thin, so that we can see through it for a brief time. Witches have always known this, but we seldom speak of it.
My father believes in it. I know because I heard him talking and showing pictures of the aurora.
Is this anything to do with dust?
Who can say? All I can tell you is that the dust hunters are as frightened of it as if it were deadly poison. That is why they imprisoned Lord Asriel.
But why?
They think he intends to use dust in some way, in order to make a bridge between this world and the world beyond the aurora.
There was a lightness in Lyra's head. She heard Father Coram say,
And does he?
Yes. They don't believe he can, because they think he is mad to believe in the other worlds in the first place. But it is true. That is his intention. And he is so powerful a figure that they feared he would upset their own plans, so they made a pact with the armored bears to capture him and keep him imprisoned in the fortress of Svalbard, out of the way. Some say they helped the new bear king to gain his throne as part of the bargain.
Do the witches want him to make this bridge? Are they on his side or against him?
That is a question with too complicated an answer. Firstly, the witches are not united. There are differences of opinion among us. Secondly, Lord Asriel's bridge will have a bearing on a war being waged at the present between some witches and various other forces, some in the spirit world. Possession of the bridge, if it ever existed, would give a huge advantage to whoever held it. Thirdly, Serafina Pekala's clan, my clan, is not yet part of any alliance, though great pressure is being put on us to declare for one side or another. You see, these are questions of high politics and not easily answered.
What about the bears? Whose side are they on?
On the side of anyone who pays them. They have no interest whatever in these questions. They have no demons. They are unconcerned about human problems. At least that is how bears used to be. But we have heard that their new king is intent on changing their old ways. At any rate, the dust hunters have paid them to imprison Lord Asriel, and they will hold him on Svalbard until the last drop of blood drains from the body of the last bear alive.
But not all bears. There's one who ain't on Svalbard at all. He's an outcast bear, and he's going to come with us.
The goose gave Lyra another of his piercing looks. This time she could feel his cold surprise. Father Coram shifted uncomfortably and said,
The fact is, Lyra, I don't think he is. We heard he's serving out a term as an indentured labourer. He ain't free, as we thought he might be. He's under sentence. Till he's discharged, he won't be free to come, armour or no armour. And he won't never have that back, either.
But he said they tricked him. They made him drunk and stole it away.
We heard a different story. He's a dangerous rogue, is what we heard.
If...
Lyra was passionate. She could hardly speak for indignation.
If the alethiometer says something, I know it's true. And I asked it, and it said that he was telling the truth. They did trick him, and they're telling lies, and not him. I believe him, Lord Farr. Farr Decorum, you saw him too, and you believe him, don't you?
I thought I did, child. I ain't so certain of things as you are.
But what are they afraid of? Do they think he's gonna go round killing people as soon as he gets his armour on? He could kill dozens of them now.
He has done. Well, if not dozens, then some. When they first took his armour away, he went a-rampaging round looking for it. He tore open the police house and the bank and I don't know where else, and there's at least two men who died. The only reason they didn't shoot to kill him is because of his wondrous skill with metals. They wanted to use him like a labourer.
Like a slave? They hadn't got the right.
Be that as it may, they might have shot him for the killings he'd done, but they didn't. And they bound him over to labour in the town's interest until he's paid off the damage and the blood money.
John, I don't know how you feel, but it's my belief they'll never let him have that armour back. The longer they keep him, the more angry he'll be when he gets it.
But if we get his armour back, he'll come with us and never bother him again. I promise, Lord Farr.
And how are we going to do that?
I know where it is.
There was a silence, in which they all three became aware of the witch's demon and his fixed stare at Lyra. All three turned to him, and their own demons too, who had until then affected the extreme politeness of keeping their eyes modestly away from this singular creature, here without his body.
You won't be surprised to know that the alethiometer is the other reason the witches are interested in you, Lyra. Our consul told us about your visit this morning. I believe it was Dr. Lancelius who told you about the bear.
Yes, it was. And she and Father Coram went there themselves and talked to him. I dare say what Lyra says is true, but if we go breaking the law of these people, we'll only get involved in a quarrel with them. And what we ought to be doing is pushing on towards this Bolvanger, bear or no bear.
Ah, but you ain't seen him, John. And I do believe Lyra. We could promise on his behalf, maybe. He might make all the difference.
What do you think, sir?
We have few dealings with bears. Their desires are as strange to us as ours are to them. If this bear is an outcast, he might be less reliable than they are said to be. You must decide for yourselves.
We will. But now, sir, can you tell us how to get to Bolvanger from here?
The goose demon began to explain. He spoke of valleys and hills, of the tree line and the tundra, of star sightings. Lyra listened a while and then lay back in the deck chair with Pantalaimon curled around her neck and thought of the grand vision the goose demon had brought with him. A bridge between two worlds. This was far more splendid than anything she could have hoped for, and only her great father could have conceived it. As soon as they had rescued the children, she would go to Svalbard with the bear and take Lord Asriel the alethiometer and use it to help set him free. And they'd build the bridge together and be the first across. Sometime in the night, John Farr must have carried Lyra to her bunk, because that was where she awoke. The dim sun was as high in the sky as it was going to get, only a hand's breadth above the horizon, so it must be nearly noon, she thought. Soon, when they moved further north, there would be no sun at all. She dressed quickly and ran on deck to find nothing very much happening. All the stores had been unloaded, sledges and dog teams had been hired and were waiting to go. Everything was ready and nothing was moving. Most of the Egyptians were sitting in a smoke-filled cafe facing the water, eating spice cakes and drinking strong sweet coffee at the long wooden tables under the fizz and crackle of some ancient Anbaric lights.
"Where's Lord Farr?"
she said, sitting down with Tony Costa and his friends.
"And Farr Decorum? Are they getting the bear's armour for him?"
"They're a-talking to the Sisselman. That's their word for governor. You've seen this bear then, Lyra?"
"Yeah,"
she said, and explained all about him. As she talked, someone else pulled a chair up and joined the group at the table.
"So, you've spoken to old Yorick."
She looked at the newcomer with surprise. He was a tall, lean man with a thin black moustache and narrow blue eyes, and a perpetual expression of distant and sardonic amusement. She felt strongly about him at once, but she wasn't sure whether it was liking she felt or dislike. His demon was a shabby hare, as thin and tough-looking as he was. He held out his hand, and she shook it warily.
Lee Scoresby.
The aeronaut! Where's your balloon? Can I go up in it?
It's packed away right now, miss. You must be the famous Lyra. How did you get on with Yorick Bjornason?
You know him?
I fought beside him in the Tunguska campaign. Hell, I've known Yorick for years. Bears are difficult critters no matter what, but he's a problem and no mistake. Say, are any of you gentlemen in the mood for a game of hazard?
A pack of cards had appeared from nowhere in his hand. He riffled them with a snapping noise.
Now, I've heard of the card power of your people,
Lee Scoresby was saying, cutting and folding the cards over and over with one hand and fishing a cigar out of his breast pocket with the other.
And I thought you wouldn't object to giving a simple Texan traveler the chance to joust with your skill and daring on the field of pasteboard combat. What do you say, gentlemen?
Egyptians prided themselves on their ability with cards, and several of the men looked interested and pulled their chairs up. While they were agreeing with Lee Scoresby what to play and for what stakes, his demon flicked her ears at Pantalaimon, who understood, and leapt to her side, lightly as a squirrel. She was speaking for Lyra's ears, too, of course, and Lyra heard her say quietly,
"Go straight to the bear and tell him direct. As soon as they know what's going on, they'll move his armor somewhere else."
Lyra got up, taking her spice cake with her, and no one noticed. Lee Scoresby was already dealing the cards, and every suspicious eye was on his hands. In the dull light, fading through an endless afternoon, she found her way to the sledge depot. It was something she knew she had to do, but she felt uneasy about it, and afraid, too. Outside the largest of the concrete sheds, the great bear was working, and Lyra stood by the open gate to watch. Yorick Bjornason was dismantling a gas engine tractor that had crashed. The metal covering of the engine was twisted and buckled, and one runner bent upward. The bear lifted the metal off as if it were cardboard, and turned it this way and that in his great hands, seeming to test it for some quality or other, before setting a rear paw on one corner and then bending the whole sheet in such a way that the dents sprang out and the shape was restored. Leaning it against the wall, he lifted the massive weight of the tractor with one paw and laid it on its side before bending to examine the crumpled runner. As he did so, he caught sight of Lyra. She felt a bolt of cold fear strike at her because he was so massive and so alien. She was gazing through the chain-link fence about 40 yards from him, and she thought how he could clear the distance in a bound or two and sweep the wire aside like a cobweb, and she almost turned and ran away. But Pantalaimon said,
"Stop! Let me go and talk to him."
He was a tern, and before she could answer he'd flown off the fence and down to the icy ground beyond it. There was an open gate a little way along, and Lyra could have followed him, but she hung back uneasily. Pantalaimon looked at her and then became a badger. She knew what he was doing. Demons could move no more than a few yards from their humans, and if she stood by the fence and he remained a bird, he wouldn't get near the bear. So he was going to pull. She felt angry and miserable. His badger claws dug into the earth and he walked forward. It was such a strange, tormenting feeling when your demon was pulling at the link between you. Part physical pain deep in the chest, part intense sadness and love. And she knew it was the same for him. Everyone tested it when they were growing up, seeing how far they could pull apart, coming back with intense relief. He tugged a little harder.
"Don't, Pan."
But he didn't stop. The bear watched, motionless. The pain in Lyra's heart grew more and more unbearable, and a sob of longing rose in her throat. Then she was through the gate, scrambling over the icy mud towards him, and he turned into a wildcat and sprang up into her arms, and they were clinging together tightly with little shaky sounds of unhappiness coming from them both.
"I thought you really would."
"No.
I couldn't believe how much it hurts."
And then she brushed the tears away angrily and sniffed hard. He nestled in her arms, and she knew she would rather die than let them be parted and face that sadness again. It would send her mad with grief and terror. If she died, they'd still be together, like the scholars in the crypt at Jordan. Then girl and demon looked up at the solitary bear. He had no demon. He was alone, always alone. She felt such a stir of pity and gentleness for him that she almost reached out to touch his matted pelt, and only a sense of courtesy towards those cold, ferocious eyes prevented her.
Yorick Bernison?
Well?
Lord Farr and Farr de Corum have gone to try and get your armour for you.
He didn't move or speak. It was clear what he thought of their chances.
I know where it is, though. And if I told you, maybe you could get it by yourself. I don't know.
How do you know where it is?
I got a symbol reader. I think I ought to tell you, Yorick Bernison. Seeing as they tricked you out of it in the first place, I don't think that's right. They shouldn't have done that. Lord Farr's going to argue with the Sisselman, but probably they won't let you have it, whatever he says. So if I tell you, will you come with us and help rescue the kids from Bolvanger?
Yes.
I...
She didn't mean to be nosy, but she couldn't help being curious. She said,
Why don't you just make some more armour out of this metal here, Yorick Bernison?
Because it's worthless. Look,
he said, and lifting the engine cover with one paw, he extended a claw on the other hand and ripped right through it like a can opener.
My armour is made of sky iron, made for me. A bear's armour is his soul, just as your demon is your soul. You might as well take him away,
indicating Pantalaimon,
and replace him with a doll full of sawdust. That is the difference. Now, where is my armour?
Listen, you've got to promise not to take vengeance. They done wrong taking it, but you just got to put up with that.
All right, no vengeance afterwards, but no holding back as I take it, either. If they fight, they die.
It's hidden in the cellar of the priest's house. He thinks there's a spirit in it, and he's been a-trying to conjure it out. But that's where it is.
He stood high up on his hind legs and looked west, so that the last of the sun coloured his face a creamy, brilliant yellow-white amid the gloom. She could feel the power of the great creature coming off him like waves of heat.
I must work till sunset. I gave my word this morning to the master here. I still owe a few minutes' work.
The sun's set where I am,
she pointed out, because from her point of view it had vanished behind the rocky headland to the southwest. He dropped to all fours.
It's true,
he said, with his face now in shadow like hers.
What's your name, child?
Lyra Belacqua.
Then I owe you a debt, Lyra Belacqua.
He turned and lurched away, padding so swiftly across the freezing ground that Lyra couldn't keep up, even running. She did run, though, and Pantalaimon flew up as a seagull to watch where the bear went and called down to tell her where to follow. Yorick Bernison bounded out of the depot and along the narrow street before turning into the main street of the town. Past the courtyard of the Sisselman's residence, where a flag hung in the still air and a sentry marched stiffly up and down, down the hill past the end of the street where the witch consul lived. The sentry by this time had realized what was happening and was trying to gather his wits, but Yorick Bernison was already turning a corner near the harbour. People stopped to watch or scuttled out of his careering way. The sentry fired two shots in the air and set off down the hill after the bear, spoiling the effect by skidding on the icy slope and only regaining his balance after seizing the nearest railings. Lyra was not far behind. As she passed the Sisselman's house, she was aware of a number of figures coming out into the courtyard to see what was going on, and thought she saw Farr de Corum among them. But then she was passed, hurtling down the street towards the corner where the sentry was already turning to follow the bear. The priest's house was older than most, and made of costly bricks. Three steps led up to the front door, which was now hanging in matchwood splinters, and from inside the house came screams and the crashing and tearing of more wood. The sentry hesitated outside, his rifle at the ready. But then, as passers-by began to gather and people looked out of windows from across the street, he realized that he had to act, and fired a shot into the air before running in. A moment later, the whole house seemed to shake. Glass broke in three windows and a tile slid off the roof, and then a maidservant ran out, terrified, her clucking hen of a demon flapping after her. Another shot came from inside the house, and then a full-throated roar made the servant scream. As if fired from a cannon, the priest himself came hurtly out, with his pelican demon in a wild flutter of feathers and injured pride. Lyra heard orders shouted and turned to see a squad of armed policemen hurrying round the corner, some with pistols and some with rifles, and not far behind them came John Farr and the stout, fussy figure of the Sisselman. A rending, splintering sound made them all look back at the house. A window at ground level, obviously opening on a cellar, was being wrenched apart with a crash of glass and a screech of tearing wood. The sentry who'd followed Yorick Bernison into the house came running out and stood to face the cellar window, rifle at his shoulder. And then the window tore open completely, and out climbed Yorick Bernison, the bear in armour. Without it, he was formidable. With it, he was terrifying. It was rust-red and crudely riveted together, great sheets and plates of dented, discoloured metal that scraped and screeched as they rode over one another. The helmet was pointed like his muzzle, with slits for eyes, and it left the lower part of his jaw bare for tearing and biting. The sentry fired several shots, and the policemen levelled their weapons too, but Yorick Bernison merely shook the bullets off like raindrops and lunged forwards in a screech and clang of metal before the sentry could escape and knocked him to the ground. His demon, a husky dog, darted at the bear's throat, but Yorick Bernison took no more notice of him than he would of a fly, and dragging the sentry to him with one vast paw, he bent and enclosed his head in his jaws. Lyra could see exactly what would happen next. He'd crush the man's skull like an egg, and there would follow a bloody fight, more deaths and more delay, and they would never get free, with or without the bear. Without even thinking, she darted forward and put her hand on the one vulnerable spot in the bear's armour, the gap that appeared between the helmet and the great plate over his shoulders when he bent his head, where she could see the yellow-white fur dimly between the rusty edges of metal. She dug her fingers in, and Pantalaimon instantly flew to the same spot and became a wildcat, crouched to defend her. But Yorick Bernison was still, and the riflemen held their fire.
Yorick, listen. You owe me a debt, right? Well, now you can repay it. Do as I ask. Don't fight these men. Just turn around and walk away with me. We want you, Yorick. You can't stay here. Just come down to the harbour with me and don't even look back. Father Corum and Lord Far, let them do the talking. They'll make it all right. Leave go this man and come away with me.
The bear slowly opened his jaws. The sentry's head, bleeding and wet and ash-pale, fell to the ground as he fainted, and his demon set about calming and gentling him as the bear stepped away beside Lyra. No one else moved. They watched the bear turn away from his victim at the bidding of the girl with the cat demon, and then they shuffled aside to make room as Yorick Bernison padded heavily through the midst of them at Lyra's side and made for the harbour. Her mind was all on him, and she didn't see the confusion behind her, the fear and the anger that rose up safely when he was gone. She walked with him, and Pantalaimon padded ahead of them both, as if to clear the way. When they reached the harbour, Yorick Bernison dipped his head and unfastened the helmet with a claw, letting it clang on the frozen ground. Egyptians came out of the café, having sensed that something was going on, and watched in the gleam of the anbaric lights on the ship's deck as Yorick Bernison shrugged off the rest of his armour and left it in a heap on the quayside. Without a word to anyone, he padded to the water and slipped into it without a ripple, and vanished.
"What's happened?"
said Tony Costa, hearing the indignant voices from the streets above, as the townsfolk and the police made their way to the harbour. Lyra told him as clearly as she could.
"But where has he gone now? He ain't just left his armour on the ground. They'll have it back as soon as they get here."
Lyra was afraid they might, too, for around the corner came the first policeman, and then more. And then the Sisselman and the priest and 20 or 30 onlookers with John Farr and Father Corum trying to keep up. But when they saw the group on the quayside, they stopped, for someone else had appeared. Sitting on the bear's armour, with one ankle resting on the opposite knee, was the long-limbed form of Lee Scoresby, and in his hand was the longest pistol Lyra had ever seen, casually pointing at the ample stomach of the Sisselman.
"Seems to me you ain't taking very good care of my friend's armour. Why, look at the rust. And I wouldn't be surprised to find moths in it, too. Now, you just stand where you are, still and easy, and don't anybody move till the bear comes back with some lubrication. Or I guess you could all go home and read the newspapers. Up to you."
"There he is,"
said Tony, pointing to a ramp at the far end of the quay, where Yorick Bernison was emerging from the water, dragging something dark with him. Once he was up on the quayside, he shook himself, sending great sheets of water flying in all directions till his fur was standing up thickly again. Then he bent to take the black object in his teeth once more and dragged it along to where his armour lay. It was a dead seal.
"Yorick,"
said the aeronaut, standing up lazily and keeping his pistol firmly fixed on the Sisselman.
"Howdy."
The bear looked up and growled briefly before ripping the seal open with one claw. Lyra watched fascinated as he laid the skin out flat and tore off strips of blubber, which he then rubbed all over his armour, packing it carefully into the places where the plates moved over one another.
"Are you with these people?"
the bear said to Lee Scoresby as he worked.
"Sure. I guess we're both hired hands, Yorick."
"Where's your balloon?"
"Packed away in two sledges. Here comes the boss."
"Bear,"
said the Sisselman in a high, harsh voice.
"For now you're allowed to depart in the company of these people. But let me tell you that if you appear within the town limits again, you will be treated mercilessly."
Yorick Birnison took not the slightest notice, but continued to rub the seal blubber all over his armour, the care and attention he was paying the task reminding Lyra of her own devotion to Pantalaimon. Just as the bear had said, the armour was his soul. The Sisselman and the policeman withdrew, and slowly the other townspeople turned and drifted away, though a few remained to watch. John Farr put his hands to his mouth and called,
"Egyptians!"
They were all ready to move. They had been itching to get underway ever since they had disembarked. The sledges were packed, the dog teams were in their traces.
"Time to move out, friends. We're all assembled now, and the road lies open. Mr. Scoresby, you all are loaded?"
"Ready to go, Lord Farr."
"And you, Yorick Birnison?"
"When I am clad."
He had finished oiling the armour. Not wanting to waste the seal meat, he lifted the carcass in his teeth and flipped it onto the back of Lee Scoresby's larger sledge before donning the armour. It was astonishing to see how lightly he dealt with it. The sheets of metal were almost an inch thick in places, and yet he swung them round and into place as if they were silk robes. It took him less than a minute, and this time there was no harsh scream of rust. So in less than half an hour, the expedition was on its way northward. Under a sky peopled with millions of stars and a glaring moon, the sledges bumped and clattered over the ruts and stones until they reached clear snow at the edge of town. Then the sound changed to a quiet crunch of snow and creak of timber, and the dogs began to step out eagerly, and the motion became swift and smooth. Lyra, wrapped up so thickly in the back of Father Coram's sledge that only her eyes were exposed, whispered to Pantalaimon.
"Can you see Yorick?
He's padding along beside Lee Scoresby's sledge,"
the demon replied, looking back in his ermine form as he clung to her wolverine fur hood. Ahead of them, over the mountains to the north, the pale arcs and loops of the northern lights began to glow and tremble. Lyra saw through half-closed eyes and felt a sleepy thrill of perfect happiness to be speeding north under the aurora. Pantalaimon struggled against her sleepiness, but it was too strong. He curled up as a mouse inside her hood. He could tell her when they woke, and it was probably a marten or a dream or some kind of harmless local spirit. But something was following the train of sledges, swinging lightly from branch to branch of the close clustering pine trees, and it put him uneasily in mind of a monkey. Chapter 12. The Lost Boy. They travelled for several hours and then stopped to eat. While the men were lighting fires and melting snow for water, with Yorick Birnison watching Lee Scoresby roast seal meat close by, John Farr spoke to Lyra.
"Lyra, can you see that instrument to read it?"
The moon itself had long set. The light from the aurora was brighter than moonlight, but it was inconstant. However, Lyra's eyes were keen, and she fumbled inside her furs and tugged out the black velvet bag.
"Yes, I can see all right. But I know where most of the symbols are by now anyway. What shall I ask it, Lord Farr?"
"I want to know more about how they're defending this place, Bolvanga."
Without even having to think about it, she found her fingers moving the hands to point to the helmet, the griffin, and the crucible, and felt her mind settle into the right meanings like a complicated diagram in three dimensions. At once the needle began to swing round, back, round and on further, like a bee dancing its message to the hive. She watched it calmly, content not to know at first, but to know that a meaning was coming, and then it began to clear. She let it dance on until it was certain.
"It's just like the witch's demon said, Lord Farr. There's a company of Tartars guarding the station, and they got wires all round it. They don't really expect to be attacked. That's what the symbol reader says. But, Lord Farr..."
"But what, child?"
"It's a-telling me something else. In the next valley... there's a village by a lake where the folk are troubled by a ghost."
John Farr shook his head impatiently and said,
"Well, that don't matter now. There's bound to be spirits of all kinds among these forests. Tell me again about them Tartars. How many, for instance? What are they armed with?"
Lyra dutifully asked, and reported the answer.
There are 60 men with rifles, and they got a couple of larger guns, sort of cannons. They got fire throwers too, and their demons are all wolves. That's what it says.
That caused a stir among the old Egyptians, those who'd campaigned before.
The Sabirsk regiments have wolf demons?
Said one.
I never met fear, sir. We shall have to fight like tigers and consult the bear. He's a shrewd warrior, that one.
Lyra was impatient and said,
Palofar, this ghost, I think it's the ghost of one of the kids.
Well, even if it is, Lyra, I don't know what anyone could do about it. 60 Sibirsk riflemen and fire throwers. Mr. Scoresby, step over here, if you would, for a moment.
While the aeronaut came to the sledge, Lyra slipped away and spoke to the bear.
Yorick, have you travelled this way before?
Once.
There's a village near, ain't there?
Over the ridge,
he said, looking up through the sparse trees.
Is it far?
For you or for me?
For me.
Too far. Not at all far for me.
How long would it take you to get there, then?
I could be there and back 3 times by next moonrise.
Because you're... Listen, I got this symbol reader that tells me things, you see, and it's told me that there's something important I've got to do over in that village, and Lord Far won't let me go there. He just wants to get on quick, and I know that's important too. But unless I go and find out what it is, we might not know what the gobblers are really doing.
The bear said nothing. He was sitting up like a human, his great paws folded in his lap, his dark eyes looking into hers down the length of his muzzle. He knew she wanted something. Pantalaimon spoke.
Can you take us there and catch up with the sledges later on?
I could, but I have given my word to Lord Far to obey him, not anyone else.
If I got his permission?
Then yes.
She turned and ran back through the snow.
Lord Far, if Yorick Bernison takes me over the ridge to the village, we can find out whatever it is and then catch the sledges up further on. He knows the route, and I wouldn't ask, except it's like what I did before, Far Decorum, you remember, with that chameleon. I didn't understand it then, but it was true, and we found out soon after. I got the same feeling now. I can't understand properly what it's saying, only I know it's important. And Yorick Bernison knows the way. He says he could get there and back 3 times by next moonrise. And I couldn't be safer than I'd be with him, could I? But he won't go without he gets Lord Far's permission.
There was a silence. Father Coram sighed. John Far was frowning and his mouth inside the fur hood was set grimly. But before he could speak, the aeronaut put in,
Lord Far, if Yorick Bernison takes the little girl, she'll be as safe as if she was here with us. All bears are true, but I've known Yorick for years, and nothing under the sky will make him break his word. Give him the charge to take care of her, and he'll do it. Make no mistake. As for speed, he can lope for hours without tiring.
But why should not some men go?
Well, they'd have to walk, because you couldn't run a sledge over that ridge. Yorick Bernison can go faster than any man over that sort of country. And I'm light enough so he won't be slowed down. And I promise, Lord Far, I promise not to be any longer than I need, and not to give anything away about us, or to get in any danger.
You sure you'll need to do this? That symbol reader ain't playing the fool with you.
It never does, Lord Far, and I don't think it could.
John Far rubbed his chin.
Well, if all comes out right, we'll have a piece more knowledge than we do now. Yorick Bernison, are you willing to do as this child bids?
I do your bidding, Lord Far. Tell me to take the child there, and I will.
Very well. You are to take her where she wishes to go and do as she bids. Lyra, I'm commanding you now. You understand?
Yes, Lord Far.
You go and search for whatever it is, and when you've found it, you turn right round and come back. Yorick Bernison, we'll be a-travelling on by that time, so you'll have to catch us up.
The bear nodded his great head.
Are there any soldiers in the village?
He said to Lyra.
Will I need my armour?
No, I'm certain of that, Yorick. Thank you, Lord Far, and I promise I'll do just as you say.
Tony Costa gave her a strip of dried seal meat to chew, and with Pantalaimon as a mouse inside her hood, Lyra clambered onto the great bear's back, gripping his fur with her mittens, and his narrow muscular back between her knees. His fur was wondrously thick, and the sense of immense power she felt was overwhelming. As if she weighed nothing at all, he turned and loped away in a long, swinging run up towards the ridge and into the low trees. It took some time before she was used to the movement, and then she felt a wild acceleration. She was riding a bear, and the aurora was swaying above them in golden arcs and loops, and all around was the bitter Arctic cold and the immense silence of the north. Yorick Birnison's paws made hardly any sound as they padded forward through the snow. The trees were thin and stunted here, for they were on the edge of the tundra, but there were brambles and snagging bushes in the path. The bear ripped through them as if they were cobwebs. They climbed the low ridge, among outcrops of black rock, and were soon out of sight of the party behind them. Lyra wanted to talk to the bear, and if he had been human, she would already be on familiar terms with him. But he was so strange and wild and cold that she was shy, almost for the first time in her life. So as he loped along, his great legs swinging tirelessly, she sat with the movement and said nothing. Perhaps he preferred that anyway, she thought. She must seem a little prattling cub, only just past babyhood, in the eyes of an armored bear. She had seldom considered herself before, and found the experience interesting but uncomfortable, very like riding the bear, in fact. Yorick Birnison was pacing swiftly, moving both legs on one side of his body at the same time, and rocking from side to side in a steady, powerful rhythm. She found she couldn't just sit, she had to ride actively. They had been traveling for an hour or more, and Lyra was stiff and sore but deeply happy, when Yorick Birnison slowed down and stopped.
"Look up."
Lyra raised her eyes and had to wipe them with the inside of her wrist, for she was so cold that tears were blurring them. When she could see clearly, she gasped at the sight of the sky. The aurora had faded to a pallid, trembling glimmer, but the stars were as bright as diamonds, and across the great, dark, diamond-scattered vault, hundreds upon hundreds of tiny black shapes were flying out of the east and south towards the north.
"Are they birds?"
"They are witches."
"Witches? What are they doing?"
"Flying to war, maybe. I have never seen so many at one time."
"Do you know any witches, Yorick?"
"I have served some, and fought some, too. This is a sight to frighten Lord Fa. If they are flying to the aid of your enemies, you should all be afraid."
"Lord Fa wouldn't be frightened. You ain't afraid, are you?"
"Not yet. When I am, I shall master the fear. But we had better tell Lord Fa about the witches, because the men might not have seen them."
He moved on more slowly, and she kept watching the sky until her eyes splintered again with tears of cold, and she saw no end to the numberless witches flying north. Finally, Yorick Birnison stopped and said,
"There is the village."
They were looking down a broken, rugged slope towards a cluster of wooden buildings beside a wide stretch of snow as flat as could be, which Lyra took to be the frozen lake. They were no more than 5 minutes from the place.
"What do you want to do?"
Lyra slipped off his back and found it hard to stand. Her face was stiff with cold and her legs were shaky, but she clung to his fur and stamped until she felt stronger.
"There's a child or a ghost or something down in that village, or maybe near it. I don't know for certain. I want to go and find him and bring him back to Lord Far and the others if I can. I thought he was a ghost, but the symbol reader might be telling me something I can't understand."
"If he is outside, he had better have some shelter."
"I don't think he's dead,"
said Lyra, but she was far from sure. The alethiometer had indicated something uncanny and unnatural, which was alarming. But who was she? Lord Asriel's daughter. And who was under her command? A mighty bear. How could she possibly show any fear?
"Let's just go and look."
She clambered on his back again, and he set off down the broken slope, walking steadily and not pacing any more. The dogs of the village smelled or heard or sensed them coming and began to howl frightfully, and the reindeer in their enclosure moved about nervously, their antlers clashing like dry sticks. In the still air, every movement could be heard for a long way. As they reached the first of the houses, Lyra looked to the right and left, peering hard into the dimness, for the aurora was fading and the moon still far from rising. Here and there a light flickered under a snow-thick roof, and Lyra thought she saw pale faces behind some of the window panes, and imagined their astonishment to see a child riding a great white bear. At the center of the little village there was an open space next to the jetty, where boats had been drawn up, mounds under the snow. The noise of the dogs was deafening, and just as Lyra thought it must have wakened everyone, a door opened and a man came out holding a rifle. His wolverine demon leapt onto the wood stack beside the door, scattering snow. Lyra slipped down at once and stood between him and Yorick Birnison, conscious that she had told the bear there was no need for his armor. The man spoke in words she couldn't understand. Yorick Birnison replied in the same language, and the man gave a little moan of fear.
He thinks we are devils. What shall I say?
Tell him we're not devils, but we've got friends who are, and we're looking for just a child, a strange child. Tell him that.
As soon as the bear had said that, the man pointed to the right, indicating some place further off, and spoke quickly. Yorick Birnison said,
He asks if we have come to take the child away. They are afraid of it. They have tried to drive it away, but it keeps coming back.
Tell him we'll take it away with us, but they were very bad to treat it like that. Where is it?
The man explained, gesticulating fearfully. Lyra was afraid he'd fire his rifle by mistake, but as soon as he'd spoken, he hastened inside his house and shut the door. Lyra could see faces at every window.
Where is the child?
In the fish house,
the bear told her, and turned to pad down towards the jetty. Lyra followed. She was horribly nervous. The bear was making for a narrow wooden shed, raising his head to sniff this way and that, and when he reached the door he stopped and said,
In there.
Lyra's heart was beating so fast she could hardly breathe. She raised her hand to knock at the door and then, feeling that that was ridiculous, took a deep breath to call out, but realized that she didn't know what to say. Oh, it was so dark now. She should have brought a lantern. There was no choice, and anyway, she didn't want the bear to see her being afraid. He had spoken of mastering his fear. That was what she'd have to do. She lifted the strap of reindeer hide holding the latch in place and tugged hard against the frost, binding the door shut. It opened with a snap. She had to kick aside the snow piled against the foot of the door before she could pull it open, and Pantalaimon was no help. Running back and forth in his ermine shape, a white shadow over the white ground, uttering little frightened sounds.
Pan, for God's sake, be a bat! Go and look for me!
But he wouldn't, and he wouldn't speak either. She had never seen him like this except once, when she and Roger in the crypt at Jordan had moved the demon coins into the wrong skulls. He was even more frightened than she was. As for Yorick Birnison, he was lying in the snow nearby, watching in silence.
Come out!
Lyra said as loud as she dared. Not a sound came in answer. She pulled the door a little wider, and Pantalaimon leapt up into her arms, pushing and pushing at her in his cat form, and said,
Go away! Don't stay here! Oh, Lyra, go now! Turn back!
Trying to hold him still, she was aware of Yorick Birnison getting to his feet, and turned to see a figure hastening down the track from the village, carrying a lantern. When he came close enough to speak, he raised the lantern and held it to show his face. An old man with a broad, lined face and eyes nearly lost in a thousand wrinkles. His demon was an Arctic fox. He spoke, and Yorick Birnison said,
He says that it's not the only child of that kind. He's seen others in the forest. Sometimes they die quickly, sometimes they don't die. This one is tough, he thinks, but it would be better for him if he died.
Ask him if I can borrow his lantern.
The bear spoke, and the man handed it to her at once, nodding vigorously. She realized that he'd come down in order to bring it to her and thanked him, and he nodded again and stood back, away from her and the hut, and away from the bear. Lyra thought suddenly, What if the child is Roger? And she prayed with all her force that it wouldn't be. Pantalaimon was clinging to her, and ermine again, his little claws hooked deep into her anorak. She lifted the lantern high and took a step into the shed, and then she saw what it was that the oblation board was doing, and what was the nature of the sacrifice the children were having to make. The little boy was huddled against the wooden drying rack where hung row upon row of gutted fish, all as stiff as boards. He was clutching a piece of fish to him as Lyra was clutching Pantalaimon, with her left hand hard against her heart. But that was all he had, a piece of dried fish, because he had no demon at all. The gobblers had cut it away. That was intercision, and this was a severed child. Chapter 13. Fencing. Her first impulse was to turn and run, or to be sick. A human being with no demon was like someone without a face, or with their ribs laid open and their heart torn out, something unnatural and uncanny that belonged to the world of night ghasts, not the waking world of sense. So Lyra clung to Pantalaimon, and her head swam and her gorge rose, and cold as the night was, a sickly sweat moistened her flesh with something colder still.
"Ratter,"
said the boy.
"You got my ratter?"
Lyra was in no doubt what he meant.
"No,"
she said in a voice as frail and frightened as she felt. Then,
"What's your name?"
"Tony Magarios. Where's Ratter?"
"I don't know,"
she began, and swallowed hard to govern her nausea.
"The gobblers..."
But she couldn't finish. She had to go out of the shed and sit down by herself in the snow, except that, of course, she wasn't by herself. She was never by herself, because Pantalaimon was always there. Oh, to be cut from him as this little boy had been parted from his ratter, the worst thing in the world. She found herself sobbing, and Pantalaimon was whimpering too, and in both of them there was a passionate pity and sorrow for the half-boy. Then she got to her feet again.
"Come on. Tony, come out. We're going to take you somewhere safe."
There was a stir of movement in the fish house, and he appeared at the door, still clutching his dried fish. He was dressed in warm enough garments, a thickly padded and quilted coal silk anorak and fur boots, but they had a second-hand look and didn't fit well. In the wider light outside that came from the faint trails of the aurora and the snow-covered ground, he looked more lost and piteous even than he had at first, crouching in the lantern light by the fish racks. The villager who'd brought the lantern had retreated a few yards and called down to them. Yorick Birnison interpreted.
"He says you must pay for that fish."
Lyra felt like telling the bear to kill him, but she said,
"We're taking the child away for them. They can afford to give one fish to pay for that."
The bear spoke. The man muttered but didn't argue. Lyra set his lantern down in the snow and took the half-boy's hand to guide him to the bear. He came helplessly, showing no surprise and no fear at the great white beast standing so close. And when Lyra helped him to sit on Yorick's back, all he said was,
"I dunno where my ratter is." "No, nor do we, Tony. But we'll punish the gobblers. We'll do that, I promise. Yorick, is it all right if I sit up there too?"
"My armor weighs far more than children."
So she scrambled up behind Tony and made him cling to the long, stiff fur. And Pantalaimon sat inside her hood, warm and close and full of pity. Lyra knew that Pantalaimon's impulse was to reach out and cuddle the little half-child, to lick him and gentle him and warm him, as his own demon would have done. But the great taboo prevented that, of course. They rose through the village and up towards the ridge, and the villagers' faces were open with horror and a kind of fearful relief at seeing that hideously mutilated creature taken away by a girl and a great white bear. In Lyra's heart, revulsion struggled with compassion, and compassion won. She put her arms around the skinny little form to hold him safe. The journey back to the main party was colder and harder and darker, but it seemed to pass more quickly for all that. Yorick Birnison was tireless, and Lyra's riding became automatic, so that she was never in danger of falling off. The cold body in her arms was so light that in one way he was easy to manage, but he was inert. He sat stiffly without moving as the bear moved, so in another way he was difficult, too. From time to time the half-boy spoke.
"What's that you said?"
"I says, is she gonna know where I am?"
"Yeah, she'll know. She'll find you, and we'll find her. Hold on tight now, Tony. It ain't far from here."
The bear loped onwards. Lyra had no idea how tired she was until they caught up with Egyptians. The sledges had stopped to rest the dogs, and suddenly there they all were, Father Coram, Lord Farr, Lee Scoresby, all lunging forward to help and then falling back silent as they saw the other figure with Lyra. She was so stiff that she couldn't even loosen her arms around his body, and John Farr himself had to pull them gently open and lift her off.
"Gracious God, what is this? Lyra, child, what have you found?"
"He's called Tony,"
she mumbled through frozen lips.
"And they cut his demon away. That's what the gobblers do."
The men held back, fearful. But the bear spoke, to Lyra's weary amazement, chiding them.
"Shame on you. Think what this child has done. You might not have more courage, but you should be ashamed to show less."
"You're right, Yorick Birnison,"
said John Farr, and turned to give orders.
"Build that fire up, and heat some soup for the child. For both children. Father Coram, is your shelter rigged?"
"It is, John. Bring her over and we'll get her warm."
"And the little boy?"
said someone else.
He can eat and get warm, even if...
Lyra was trying to tell John Farr about the witches, but they were all so busy and she was so tired. After a confusing few minutes full of lantern light, wood smoke, figures hurrying to and fro, she felt a gentle nip on her ear from Pantalaimon's ermine teeth, and woke to find the bear's face a few inches from hers.
The witches,
Pantalaimon whispered.
I called Yorick.
Oh, yeah. Yorick, thank you for taking me there and back. I might not remember to tell Lord Farr about the witches, so you better do that instead of me.
She heard the bear agree, and then she fell asleep properly. When she woke up, it was as close to daylight as it was ever going to get. The sky was pale in the southeast, and the air was suffused with a grey mist through which the gypsies moved like bulky ghosts, loading sledges and harnessing dogs to the traces. She saw it all from the shelter on Father Coram's sledge, inside which she lay under a heap of furs. Pantalaimon was fully awake before she was, trying the shape of an arctic fox before reverting to his favourite ermine. Yorick Bjornsson was asleep in the snow nearby, his head on his great paws, but Father Coram was up and busy, and as soon as he saw Pantalaimon emerge, he limped across to wake Lyra properly. She saw him coming and sat up to speak.
Father Coram, I know what it was that I couldn't understand. The alethiometer kept saying bird and not, and that didn't make sense, because it meant no demon, and I didn't see how it could be. What is it?
Lyra, I'm afraid to tell you this after what you done, but that little boy died an hour ago. He couldn't settle, he couldn't stay in one place. He kept asking after his demon where she was she a coming soon and all. And he kept such a tight hold on that bare old piece of fish as if... Oh, I can't speak of it, child. But he closed his eyes finally and fell still. And that was the first time he looked peaceful. For he was like any other dead person then, with their demon gone in the course of nature. They've been a-trying to dig a grave for him. But the earth's bound like iron. So John Farr ordered a fire built, and they're going to cremate him, so as not to have him despoiled by carrion eaters. Child, you did a brave thing and a good thing, and I'm proud of you. Now we know what terrible wickedness those people are capable of, we can see our duty plainer than ever. What you must do is rest and eat, because you fell asleep too soon to restore yourself last night. And you have to eat in these temperatures to stop yourself getting weak.
He was fussing around, tucking the furs into place, tightening the tension rope across the body of the sledge, running the traces through his hands to untangle them.
Father Coram, where is the little boy now? Have they burned him yet?
No, Lyra. He's a lying back there.
I want to go and see him.
He couldn't refuse her that, for she'd seen worse than a dead body, and it might calm her. So with Pantalaimon as a white hare bounding delicately at her side, she trudged along the line of sledges to where some men were piling brushwood. The boy's body lay under a checkered blanket beside the path. She knelt and lifted the blanket in her mittened hands. One man was about to stop her, but the others shook their heads. Pantalaimon crept close as Lyra looked down on the poor, wasted face. She slipped her hand out of the mitten and touched his eyes. They were marble cold, and Father Coram had been right. Poor little Tony Macarius was no different from any other human whose demon had departed in death. Oh, if they took Pantalaimon from her! She swept him up and hugged him as if she meant to press him right into her heart. And all little Tony had was his pitiful piece of fish. Where was it? She pulled the blanket down. It was gone. She was on her feet in a moment and her eyes flashed fury at the men nearby.
Where's his fish?
They stopped, puzzled, unsure what she meant, though some of their demons knew and looked at one another. One of the men began to grin uncertainly.
Don't you dare laugh! I'll tear your lungs out if you laugh at him! That's all he had to cling on to! Just an old dry fish! That's all he had for a demon to love and be kind to! Who took it from him? Where's it gone?
Pantalaimon was a snarling snow leopard, just like Lord Asriel's demon, but she didn't see that. All she saw was right and wrong.
Easy, Lyra,
said one man.
Easy, child!
Whose took it?
She flared again, and the Egyptian took a step back from her passionate fury.
I didn't know,
said another man apologetically.
I thought it was just what he'd been eating. I took it out of his hand because I thought it was more respectful. That's all, Lyra.
Then where is it?
the man said uneasily.
Not thinking he had a need for it. I gave it to my dogs. I do beg your pardon.
It ain't my pardon you need, it's his,
she said, and turned at once to kneel again and laid her hand on the dead child's icy cheek. Then an idea came to her, and she fumbled inside her furs. The cold air struck through as she opened her anorak, but in a few seconds she had what she wanted, and took a gold coin from her purse before wrapping herself close again.
I want to borrow your knife,
she said to the man who'd taken the fish, and when he let her have it, she said to Pantalaimon,
what was her name?
He understood, of course, and said,
Ratta.
She held the coin tight in her left mittened hand, and, holding the knife like a pencil, scratched the lost demon's name deeply into the gold.
I hope that'll do, if I provide for you like a Jordan scholar,
she whispered to the dead boy, and forced his teeth apart to slip the coin into his mouth. It was hard, but she managed it, and managed to close his jaw again. Then she gave the man back his knife, and turned in the morning twilight to go back to Father Coram. He gave her a mug of soup straight off the fire, and she sipped it greedily.
What are we going to do about them witches, Father Coram? I wonder if your witch was one of them.
My witch? I wouldn't presume that far, Lyra. They might be going anywhere. There's all kinds of concerns that plague on the life of witches. Things invisible to us. Mysterious sicknesses they fall prey to, which we shrug off. Causes of war, quite beyond our understanding. Joys and sorrows, bound up with the flowering of tiny plants up on the tundra. But I wish I'd seen them a-flying, Lyra. I wish I'd been able to see a sight like that. Now, drink up all that soup. Do you want some more? There's some pan bread a-cooking, too. Eat up, child, because we're on our way soon.
The food revived Lyra, and presently the chill at her soul began to melt. With the others, she went to watch the little half-child laid on his funeral pyre, and bowed her head and closed her eyes for John Farr's prayers. And then the men sprinkled cold spirit and set matches to it, and it was blazing in a moment. Once they were sure he was safely burned, they set off to travel again. It was a ghostly journey. Snow began to fall early on, and soon the world was reduced to the grey shadows of the dogs ahead, the lurching and creaking of the sledge, the biting cold, and a swirling sea of big flakes only just darker than the sky and only just lighter than the ground. Through it all, the dogs continued to run, tails high, breath puffing steam. North and further north they ran, while the pallid noontide came and went and the twilight wrapped itself again around the world. They stopped to eat and drink and rest in a fold of the hills and to get their bearings, and while John Farr talked to Lee Scoresby about the way they might best use the balloon, Lyra thought of the spy fly, and she asked Father Coram what had happened to the smoke leaf tin he'd trapped it in.
I've got it tucked away tight. It's down in the bottom of that kit bag. But there's nothing to see. I soldered it shut on board ship like I said I would. I don't know what we're going to do with it, to tell you the truth. Maybe we could drop it down a fire mine. Maybe that would settle it. But you needn't worry, Lyra. While I've got it, you're safe.
The first chance she had, she plunged her arm down into the stiffly frosted canvas of the kit bag and brought up the little tin. She could feel the buzz it was making before she touched it. While Father Coram was talking to the other leaders, she took the tin to Yorick Birnison and explained her idea. It had come to her when she remembered his slicing so easily through the metal of the engine cover. He listened, and then took the lid of a biscuit tin and deftly folded it into a small, flat cylinder. She marvelled at the skill of his hands. Unlike most bears, he and his kin had opposable thumb claws with which they could hold things still to work on them. And he had some innate sense of the strength and flexibility of metals, which meant that he only had to lift it once or twice, flex it this way and that, and he could run a claw over it in a circle to score it for folding. He did this now, folding the sides in and in until they stood in a raised rim and then making a lid to fit it. At Lyra's bidding, he made two. One the same size as the original smoke leaf tin, and another just big enough to contain the tin itself and a quantity of hairs and bits of moss and lichen all packed down tight to smother the noise. When it was closed, it was the same size and shape as the alethiometer. When that was done, she sat next to Yorick Birnison as he gnawed a haunch of reindeer that was frozen as hard as wood.
Yorick, is it hard not having a demon? Don't you get lonely?
Lonely? I don't know. They tell me this is cold. I don't know what cold is because I don't freeze, so I don't know what lonely means either.